Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Heute spreche ich mit Laura McInerney, die uns einige Perspektiven aus Großbritannien aufzeigt. Insbesondere finde ich interessant, dass man dort Schulen individuell enabled hat, Software und Hardware zu kaufen und es fast keine Landeslizenzen gibt. Außerdem sehr spannend, ein großer kultureller Unterschied. Es gibt dort praktisch keine große Debatte über Big Tech und digitale Souveränität im Bildungssystem. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
Laura McInerney, it's great to have you on the show. You are a person who's had to gather a lot of experience in the education sector. You've been a teacher in London. You've been a journalist for many years, writing articles for The Guardian, and you're also an EdTech founder. Now, your role as an EdTech founder is something we would really like to learn more about today, but we would also very much like to get your view on how the UK is actually doing these days when it comes to schooling, digitization, and the lockdown. But maybe let's look at your company first. Could you give us the elevator pitch for what you're doing as a professional these days?
Sure. So I'm co-founder of a company called Education Intelligence, but people know us more by our apps. And our two apps are Teacher Tap, that's Tap with two P's, and Parent Ping. So Teacher Tap and Parent Ping are daily surveys. They sit on teachers' and parents' phones. They ping once a day. There are a couple of questions that you answer, and then you get to see the results of those live questions. And it means that for teachers who are often in their own classrooms and don't get to see what's happening in other people's classrooms, you get to find out what other teachers are doing. And the same for parents. It can be as simple for teachers as, where do you eat your lunch? For parents, it might be, how much do you spend on a birthday present for your child, for example, or whether you are celebrating a birthday in a particular way. And it just gives everybody a way of understanding what's happening in their communities, which is helpful for the users, but also then we use those insights to inform governments, policymakers, and a lot of other ed tech and technology businesses as well, so that they can adapt and make their products better for teachers and parents.
Wow, that's some really next level stuff if I compare it to the data we have or that we don't have in Germany at the moment. So as I understand it right, you're in the UK, you're quite big, and you're also in active in other countries. Can you give us an idea of the scale that you're working on right now?
Yep. So we're predominantly across the UK, but really very focused in England. So in the UK, we have a kind of a system which is broken down by the countries of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, each have their own education system. So we have some users from those countries, but we're mainly focused in England. And then also we have TeacherTap Netherlands, Flanders, that's in Belgium. And we also have TeacherTap Ghana, which has been a project for the last year. And we've kind of become a bit of an envy of many other countries, because during lockdown last year, lots of countries couldn't continue to work out their GDP for education, so how productive their schools were. However, in England, the official National Statistics Office here used TeacherTap to look at teachers' working hours to find out exactly how much education was still being delivered remotely. And we could do really accurate GDP statistics, which is fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. In Germany, it's such a black box, and you only can gather anecdata. Yeah. Politicians, they don't know. Yeah. They simply don't know. And parents are saying it very much depends on the teacher you have. Yeah. Do you have someone who's computer illiterate? Then tough job when it comes to homeschooling. Or do you have someone who's really embracing digitization and it's great? And you're collecting this data on a large scale. So I think you're roughly at 10,000 teachers who participate in your survey right now.
That's right. So about one in 50 teachers in England is on the app every day. And so they answer the questions all of the time. And then we've got about 4,000, I think, in the other countries now and growing. And so what we're seeing are some really interesting country differences. For example, we asked recently about remote and home teaching and whether or not you are required for your pupils to have their cameras on or off when you're teaching them. What we find in the UK amongst secondary pupils is the main policy is cameras off. Children have to have their cameras off. In the Netherlands, it's the opposite. There, the majority of teachers are required to have their children's cameras on. So a tiny little policy, but it has huge implications for the experience, for the user, for how the family might feel about remote learning. And that's just one difference between England and the Netherlands. So really fascinating stuff already. I don't know what's happening in Germany, but really interesting.
Well, I'm afraid there's a lot of teachers who'd say no cameras at all, because it's a big discussion on what tools to use. And data security is a very big discussion that most schools hadn't had a chance to do video conferencing as a routine. Did you stumble upon these findings too? Or would you say the UK, always being quite ahead of Germany when it comes to digitization, didn't have the problem of whether it's Zoom, Google Meet, or an open source version?
No, we had huge problems. So in the lockdown last year, so our schools closed from the end of March in 2020 through to pretty much September for most year groups. At that time, fewer than 10% of schools were doing any kind of live streamed video lesson in the state sector. This year, since we've closed in January, it's around 60% of schools. And that's because in the past 12 months, most schools have got themselves more established with things like Teams and Classrooms very much dominating now, but a whole variety of different platforms. Also pre-recorded video, so software like Loom has become very popular in England, so that people can record in advance. But it's whether or not the pupils have the cameras on or off seems to be the big contention here. And for a long time, there were a lot of worries that if children had their cameras on, then, you know, somebody could drop in inappropriately, or in one case we heard of a parent who'd walked, you know, from a shower to a bedroom in the background not realizing that their child was on screen, which that's just awful for everybody involved, isn't it? So I think the English being very into their privacy, we've gone more for cameras off.
Now, with two-thirds on video calls these days, what's happening to the last third? Is it more a conscious decision of the teacher to not do it? Or is it also an infrastructure and a technical problem?
We're finding that most schools, if they're not doing live streamed video lessons, they're still doing a live lesson in which there is some element of live chat, or children are able to download pre-recorded videos. There's about 15% of our schools that are still using physical take-home workbooks in almost all circumstances. Those are in the most deprived areas. And we have struggled with the digital divide. We've done a bunch of research with an organisation called the Sutton Trust, and they commissioned us to look very carefully at disparities in families who are very affluent versus not affluent and what that actually means. And of course, what you see is there are a group of students, they're small, but they don't have good internet access. They're often working on old phones with data packages that are very expensive, and therefore they simply can't access work online. And therefore these schools have said, well, we'll also print off physical workbooks and printers. That has been fascinating on ParentPing. You know, only about 50% of families that we've polled on ParentPing have a printer. So if schools are assuming that families will be able to print off worksheets or workbooks, then actually that's not right. And many families don't have lined paper for children to write down on. They only have blank paper for their printer, or in fact, they don't have any paper at all because they're a digital household. So again, for those younger children where there's an assumption, you know, go and write in a workbook and practice your spelling, that isn't something that every child can do.
Can you walk us through the typical resources teachers and students would have before the lockdown in the UK? What was like the standard before the pandemic broke out?
I mean, it was very rare that you had a school where there were one-to-one devices. In fact, we'd seen since 2018, when we first started asking about laptops and devices in school, we'd seen them gradually reducing in usage. And that's because England had a very particular strategy. Since 2010, we've had one government party really in power, and they've been on a austerity kick, so cutting back on school budgets. We had a lot of technology put into schools for the previous 10 years, 2000 to 2010. And so all of that software, all of that hardware has got old. Licenses have run out and it's not been renewed. So there had been a focus instead on textbooks, on direct instruction, on writing in workbooks. And it meant that when the pandemic hit, we were very, very badly served. Most schools might have had, you know, a few laptop trays, but it just wasn't something that people had invested in.
And how about learning management systems? Teachers having professional email addresses or having to use their private ones? How was the whole communication set up?
Even that was really difficult. So one of the reasons why it was so slow last year, not just to move to online systems, but last year we had about 50% of primary schools sending physical workbooks home. The majority of primary schools did not have an online content system. Actually, about 65-70% of secondary schools did, but how well used they were, you know, they might have had bought them, there might have been a few very enthusiastic teachers using them, but they weren't widely used. And so at least half of our younger year groups didn't have any access whatsoever to a learning management system. Again, dramatically changed. Almost every school now has some kind of online platform, and no one now, or very few people, are uploading to websites, which is what they were doing last year with a few PDFs on a Monday and telling people to print them off for the week. We've moved on, thankfully, from that now.
And when it comes to the decision making on what kind of software to use in Germany, it's a very big discussion. Should we use open source? Should we program something from scratch, create it again, even though maybe something with the same functionality exists somewhere else? But if we do it ourselves from tax money in kind of like a publicly owned company, so not a private for profit, then at least we own the data. And the student data is very safe. So there's this big discussion, is it big tech, Microsoft, Google? Is it maybe other European businesses who run the learning management systems? Or do we do it ourselves and it's a state-run initiative? How did the UK go when it comes to this decision?
That's a fascinating question. Can I just check, in Germany then, is it that do the states or big federations purchase on behalf of all of the schools?
There's not a clear line. Everyone's doing it differently, but we've got 16 states and every state does it their own way. And since we've kind of like let the digitization just happen without orchestrating, without organizing it, you've got this gigantic divide. Schools who've done their own thing, they've got their own learning management system in place. They've just done it all themselves. They used Moodle or something else. And you've got schools who haven't done anything. And now it's very tough to kind of harmonize and bring everyone together. So it's not easy for the states right now to kind of like create a one-fits-all solution, because there's these early adopter schools who already have everything in place, up and running, and it's running fine. Mm. Big mix here. Yeah? But in general, you've got the Moodle learning management systems. You've got a couple of smaller German companies who are providing some sort of learning management system. You've got the big Norwegian It's Learning company, learning management system. And sometimes people also use Google Classroom, but it's very rare. Google has not been present here. Google is perceived as the big advertising data collector, and a lot of people don't have a good gut feeling when it comes to Google and data. Plus, we've got Microsoft, especially Teams, some people are using that, but they also get criticized for actually working with an American company here.
That's so interesting. It's very different here. So the picture in England is that we don't do mass procurements, which I know happen in some other countries. It's very much been every school for themselves. And we now have things called academy trusts, which is where multiple schools can work in a federation together. And they might have up to 60, maybe now getting up towards 100 schools, but they're still quite rare. So what you've got are kind of 24,000 schools all scrambling to do their own thing, again, without a strategic focus, and in the context of budgets being cut for about a decade. Because of that, there are a few providers that I think have flourished. We also don't tend to find culturally the same concerns about data. And also we don't tend to find concerns around working with big corporates. Maybe again, because it's an English speaking country foremost, we're very used to dealing with American products, and therefore we don't get alternatives that grow up just for us. Therefore, Google Classrooms, Microsoft Teams have been big winners. We've also got things like Seesaw, Firefly, a couple of others that have come through as really good learning platforms. Learning Ladders is a UK company that's developing and building.
It's very interesting. Now, looking at TeacherTap, are the governments fans of yours, or are they saying, oh my God, no, you're actually making it so visible, you're generating the data that makes schools comparable, school districts comparable. We'd rather not want to see that data because it actually puts us under pressure.
I have a long history with the government. So because I was a journalist, I actually became a journalist from being a teacher because I was taken to court by the then Education Secretary, Michael Gove, for asking a question. So I asked to see some data about a set of schools that were being opened. I was doing a PhD study and I wanted the data for my studies. I didn't think I was asking for the Pentagon Papers or anything controversial. And under our freedom of information laws, which were very new, England came to freedom of information very late. I was taken to court for being vexatious, which is this technical work for being kind of a horrible, difficult person. Wow. I won eventually. So we went to court several times. It kept getting appealed and then they pulled out at the end and just gave me what I wanted. But throughout the process, it was quite, you know, it was quite challenging to be a teacher. I was still reasonably young at the time. And I represented myself in court because I wasn't entitled to lawyers for various reasons to do with how they changed the law so that there was less money available for people to represent themselves. Represented by lawyers, so I represented myself. And wow. Through that court case, what I decided to do, I was only about 30, and I knew if I stood up in a courtroom with, it was three male judges, male barristers from the Information Commissioner's Office, male barristers from the Department for Education, and I'm quite a tiny person, I have a little stature. And so I thought, I'm going to look like I'm on work experience, like I'm the apprentice if I stand up there. So I wore yellow as a way of representing sunshine and transparency and letting the light in on data, because I think transparency is really important. And we try really hard with TeachTap. One of the reasons why we show the results is because most market research companies don't do that. They ask you lots of questions in your survey and then they sell the data, but you never learn. You never find out what the results were. And we wanted the teachers to learn as we were learning, as the government and policymakers and research commissioners were learning with us. So that's why it's in there and built in. So the government are very used to me with my yellow jackets, turning up to interview them for court cases, for anything else. And I think a long time ago, I got them to accept, really. They don't love it. And as a business founder, there are times when I know transparency is really hard. And as an editor of a newspaper, there were times when I was challenged and I thought, man, I really wish transparency wasn't one of my values right now, because I don't want to have to talk about this thing. But once we get over that and we embrace the idea that actually sharing information is good and we've got to stand in our light and our truth as much as possible, then good things tend to happen. And so the government haven't been negative about TeachTap. They've used the data. 2 years ago, the Education Secretary at the time used our data about how many emails teachers were doing per day to look again at workload and email policies in schools. Because if teachers are emailing for 7 hours a day, then that's more than a day of teaching a week. So they're happy to use the data. And as I say, we are part of the official National Statistics GDP. So yeah, we've won them over, I think, a little bit.
Very cool. And so they're also funding you?
They're not funding us. No. So they could commission questions from us. So obviously the Office for National Statistics have commissioned research from us. They're not a funder. We're not a public body. We are a for-profit business who work as an independent market research company.
Fantastic. So who's paying you today? Who's generating revenue so you can live and pay your employees and your bills?
Yep. So we work, as I said before, for example, the Sutton Trust. They're a very large organisation in the UK looking at social mobility, and they commissioned us to do a big study with them this month. We've been commissioned by the Education Endowment Foundation to look at parents during lockdown and how they feel, because we get all the teachers' view now. I've spent 3 years on the news talking about teachers. Teachers think this, teachers think that. But what about parents? They're now doing a lot of the teachers' job. So we're now doing this big work with the EEF. And we're also commissioned often by edtech companies who want to find out, you know, if there were two products on offer, which one would teachers prefer? That is a question I can ask. And within 24 hours, we'll know the answer.
Super cool. How long are these surveys usually?
So it's usually 3 questions a day for teachers. For parents, it depends how many children you have. And they sit on your phone for 24 hours. Once the 24 hours is up, the results show up, and then you get another set of 3 questions. We get about 8,500 responses in that time. And in the background, we're able to reweight that and make it representative of the teaching population and do lots of cool calculations. So again, the EdTech company can look, we see this all the time. They can look and see if a head teacher likes a product versus if a classroom teacher does. And you know, often those are very different. What head teachers want in a product is not the same as what a classroom teacher wants.
And are people concerned about the data they give you, or is it very clear that it's all anonymous?
Yeah, they haven't been so far. We were very conscientious when we set up, because we set up in 2017 and GDPR was due to come in March 2018. So we knew from the beginning, because we ask questions every day. We can be very consent based. So if we ever change our terms and conditions, we just ask that day's questions. Hey, this is a new thing we're doing. Are you okay with this? Would you like our newsletter? Yes or no? You say no, you don't get our newsletter. And the way that we do the statistics is that they're aggregates. So 8,500 at a national level, it's 20% of classroom teachers said this, or 16% of teachers said that. And we're very careful, because my co-founder is Professor Becky Allen. She's a quantitative data education specialist, and she worked previously on our national pupil database. And that's obviously much more sensitive. So, yeah, we've worked really hard to make sure that it's as carefully managed as possible.
It's fantastic. It must be a gigantic idea generator all the time when we're discussing and we don't know which idea is better or not. You can simply run the surveys and you can prove with some data what would actually be the next good step to introduce into the education system. What might be a good step, but no one will accept it. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, because we all know it's about the teacher in the end. Yeah, it's about what teachers would like to use and where they feel comfortable and where they don't.
Exactly. And it helps us to have sometimes quite difficult conversations. To go back to the email thing, what we found is that teachers are really divided. About half of teachers answer their emails during holidays and weekends in England, and about half don't. And the half that don't do find it really quite irritating that the other half do. But the half that do really don't want to be stopped. And when we've polled about things like out of office policies, so obviously in France, there are rules around when you can email your employees. And when we've mentioned the idea that these might be brought in England, you know, people get very angry about this. And it's good to be able to present the data and show both sides that there is another side, because we so often think that everyone thinks like us, especially when we're in a profession, or especially if we're in one town and everybody we know all thinks a certain way. And to be able to present that data back, even when it's uncomfortable, we do cause some rift sometimes, is a good thing, because it gets everybody talking and appreciating that not everyone thinks like them. They're the best results, the surprising ones.
So where can TeacherTap go? I'm thinking in Germany, at least in my point of view, we're really lacking a certain level of civic engagement when it comes to school reforms and just improving the school system in general. Yeah, it seems like so much is left to the state to decide. Yeah, we think of new curriculum. Well, some experts at the state will take care of it. Parents are not involved. Employers are not involved. Teachers are not involved. With a tool like yours, it would be so much easier to actually involve a lot of people and see what do we actually want to change and how would you change it? Give us some ideas.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny you say that, because the view in England is always that in Germany, employers are massively consulted when it comes to curriculum. And the view is you are the pinnacle. So it's really interesting to hear you say that. I think that, you know, we are expanding into other countries. So we've done Netherlands, Flanders, got a few in line for the future. And what we do is we work with partners in those countries. We've particularly partnered so far with universities, but we're also looking at research hubs and would be interested in speaking with governments as well. So it's a reasonably easy thing actually to internationalize. And sometimes we ask the same questions in every country, which is fascinating and gives us all of these cool insights. So that's one place for us to go. Obviously with ParentPing, we're still growing that. And again, getting an international audience will be interesting. I suppose for us, we want to work out if there are more things that we can do to support and help the teachers. One of the things at the very end, after you've answered the result questions, you've seen the results, there's a little daily read, and it just points to somewhere on the internet that you can read, maybe a 2 or 3 minute blog. They're not our blogs, they're other people's, and they will usually help you with your practice. That has been wildly popular. So finding ways that we could maybe make that better, more in tune with what people are answering or want to read about, I think would be a real benefit. And maybe finding ways to reflect back to the teachers all of the learning that they've done on the app, or finding ways to get them more access to data and being able to compare their own views to others would be really good. That's where we would like to go next, because it is about helping the communities learn first. And then once they know stuff, they'll make better decisions in the classroom, as well as helping everybody else, businesses, employers, curriculum, anybody, to learn what teachers, parents think, want, need.
Cool. I've got one question for you as a journalist. Mm-hmm. And your work as a journalist. Sometimes it seems to me writing about education, like really about the educational system, is a super tough job, because it's not an easy topic. Yeah, it's a super important subject. You've got a lot of people who are deeply concerned. It actually concerns all of us. But to get a quite complex situation into a piece of an article that's easily to read, easy to understand, is sometimes tough, because you've got ministries, you've got administration, you've got the history of the whole thing and how it all happened. Did you also find it tough to write about educational systematic changes and try to make that snackable, digestible for a mainstream audience?
No, but only because I have a family that are quite impatient and very loud. So as a child, if you wanted to get the room, you had to say something important, short, and easy to understand. So I was trained from a young age to be pithy. In terms of writing, I also taught in a school for 6 years where the majority of my pupils didn't speak English as their first language. And that taught me to write much more clearly, or they wouldn't understand me. So I think that helped. The other thing with journalists, and I was the editor of a newspaper here in England called Schools Week. At the time, almost no journalists in the UK on any national paper who covered education or in the specialist press had themselves been teachers. And I do think it's quite difficult to fully understand all of the technicalities of an industry, all of the ins and outs, the acronyms and everything else, without having lived it. That doesn't mean those journalists don't do an exceptional job. They do. But being a journalist is really hard. You are, you know, one minute you're writing about curriculum, the next you're writing about safeguarding, then someone's got an IT system they want you to write about, the next you're talking about a court case and government policy. You've got 10, 15 minutes, and those people often come to the brief brand new. So if you stay in education a long time, you pick it up. But otherwise, I often feel that journalists are doing an incredible job with no one really helping them and picking up lots of bits and pieces, whereas I had 6 years of being in the classroom, so that was helpful. I had a really good network on Twitter of teachers who always helped me out. And I had a family that taught me, speak quickly, get on with it, and say it simply.
Fantastic. Did you teach at a private school or at a state school?
I taught in a free state school here in London. I actually taught in two, and I taught mostly children aged 11 to 18.
And what role do the private schools play in developing the overall education system? Are they a big driver because they create competition and they're always a little bit faster, or do you see it more critical?
Oh, such an interesting question. They are important in England. They do dominate a lot of the debate. There's only 7% of children, roughly, at any time in the private sector within the UK. But they get a lot more airtime. Last year, during lockdown, they moved very quickly to doing all online live stream lessons. So their children got even further ahead. And so it's coming up as a big issue now that the digital divide really helped those who could afford to pay for school to get even further ahead and those who couldn't to get behind. On the other hand, I look at the state sector in the UK and it has got just so much better in the last 20 years, leaps and bounds. And when you look at our PISA scores, actually, once they're standardized for socioeconomic background, really, there isn't that much difference between the private school achievement rates and the state school achievement rates, which tells you how well they're doing. And London schools, where I taught, London schools had a huge turnaround 20 years ago and are now some of, well, they are the best schools within the UK. And I believe they're still some of the most outstanding schools in any capital city across Europe. So I think our state sector has done a lot. And because of that, the conversation isn't so important. And when my children in school used to say to me about private school children and they'll never be able to compete, I used to just say, ignore them. You know, you are where you are. You've just got to get your good grades, get on with it. And there's only 7% of them anyway, so don't worry about it. It was maybe a bit of a white lie, but I do think we can't worry about it too much.
So looking into the future, coming out of this pandemic, what is going to stay? What's going to change in the long term when I look into a UK classroom?
The good news is we've asked. So our teachers on TeacherTap have told us that the place they see the biggest gains, which will stay, is in homework. So what the pupils do at home, because they can now get, there's apps, there's subscriptions, they're used to uploading their work. They're using a lot more things like Google Form. So it's automatically marked, and then it can go into things like Google Classrooms, Microsoft Teams. A big one is, instead of writing out feedback to children, doing it with voice notes or audio. And there are all kinds of little plugins now that you can get that help with that. And teachers, I think, just are a lot more confident with their tools. They're more likely to give things a go and see that there might be a benefit and an efficiency going forwards. What they don't believe, and what we haven't yet found in the data, is any workload gain. So we're not seeing that because they're using online systems and they automatically mark or they automatically do work, that they're working fewer hours yet. And possibly that will never happen, because teachers always want to do right by their pupils. And if they can use an hour that's just been saved by an automation to sit with a child for an hour and listen to their problems, learn about their day, teach them a new skill, then they'll probably do that instead. But how good that some of the other admin has been taken off their plate.
Wow. Thank you for the super clear and crisp idea of what's happening next. Laura, thank you so much. I very much enjoyed this half hour talking to you. Hope I can talk to you again one of these days, and good luck with TeacherTap.
Thank you. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much.